Good times. Since the weather was finally warming after the bitter freeze and the bloody thaw, Savine had been keen to throw open the doors of the palace and hold a reception in the budding gardens. Spring and a new beginning, and a sorely needed opportunity to heal wounds. Wounds of the great change, still far from scarred over, and wounds inflicted since, still bleeding. But the evening was not so balmy as she had hoped, and the goose flesh on her bare arms made her think of the brutal winter just past. The braying laughter of someone drunk too soon brought back the rioters' clamour in the square of marshals. The glint of torches on the armour of the many guards reminded her of the flames towering into the sky above the court of the people. She wanted to run for her chambers, lock every door, and hold her children close. But she had hidden too long. So she squared her shoulders, snapped her fingers at Zuri to pass the box, and took another pinch of pearl dust instead. Savine was far from the only one on edge. Her guests were those lucky, clever, or treacherous enough to have lived through the fury of the mobs, the chaos of Rizinau, the massacres of Judge. Now, after the briefest period of heady relief, they were starting to wonder if they might end up purged by their new Lord Regent. Leo was in no mood to heal wounds. He stood grim and aloof, as usual, surrounded by armed Anglanders, as usual, refusing to sit down, as usual. He had taken Adure in a vice-like grip the day Judge fell, but since Orso's escape, and with Durin to help, he had instigated a crackdown far harsher than any the Burners had dreamed of. The endless restrictions and searches, curfews and tests of loyalty were bad for morale and terrible for business. The only people prospering were armourers, flag makers, and the painters daubing union emblems on the homes of citizens terrified of showing inadequate patriotism. Leo insisted he was infusing Adua with common purpose, oblivious to the fact that nothing proclaims disunity like shrill proclamations of unity on every corner.
"My lords and ladies!"
The panicky chatter subsided, every eye turning towards the gateway in the palace wall, flanked by two giant sun banners. The announcer puffed himself up with a mighty breath.
"Might I present?"
He glanced nervously towards Leo, then, as if embarrassed by the lack of a suitably magnificent string of titles, deflated.
"Black Ricker."
Savine knew how to make an entrance. She had engineered some classics in her time, started new trends at the Solar Society, radiantly happy at her wedding, proudly defiant at her trial. But she was not sure that she ever made an entrance like Ricker did that day.
"Someone has been to the tailor," murmured Zuri.
The new mistress of the North was a heady concoction of high fashion, black magic, and barbaric splendour, with a weird twist all her own. Her dress was of fine red Suljuk silk, long and lean, like a streak of blood, with a cloud of white fur about the shoulders. Her hair was bound up into a ridiculously tall, impossibly shiny black gentleman's hat, cocked right over in the manner of a backstreet pimp. She showed every one of those fine teeth in a knowing smile, the emeralds that Savine once gave her shining at her throat, but her eyes shining brighter, one all white, the other all gaping pupil in the centre of those tattooed witch's rings. She raised her sinewy arms and spread them wide, Sipanese lace gloves on her hands, but chains, runes, and bone bangles dangling from her wrists.
"Greetings from the North,"
she screeched, and a strange entourage spilled through the gate and into the heart of the Union. At Ricker's right shoulder came Issa Nifail, dressed like a duchess, but walking like a docker, necklace of finger bones around her neck and the toes of her heavy boots peeping under the lace hem of her skirt. Call Shivers was on her left,
oddly at ease in a braid-heavy general's uniform, paired with a savage-looking broadsword, metal eye glinting behind his hanging grey hair. There were hill women, whose faces were stained with swirling tattoos. There were warriors, whose faces were crisscrossed with scars. There were craftsmen of Carlion, and ship's captains of Ufrith, and all with odd specks and spatters of Union fashion. A crystal-knobbed cane, a machine-patterned shawl, a jewelled pocket watch. One hillman peered suavely through a monocle, as though he'd been born wearing one. Savine! And Ricker slipped between her outstretched hands and folded her in a hug. Savine could hardly remember the last time anyone held her that way, and she found herself squeezing Ricker back, as if they truly were old friends, with no jealousies or rivalries or backstabbings behind them. She found herself both reluctant to let go and relieved when Ricker did, holding her out at arm's length with that unsettling grin. Magic was not a thing one could sensibly invest in, of course, but looking into the black depths of the long eye, she could not help wondering what Ricker might have seen with it, what she might know that Savine could not guess.
Ricker, you are a vision. Ha! Vision. Saying you look good would be like calling snow cold, but I swear you look better than ever. Motherhood must agree with you. Mother of the nation, no less.
None of us came through the great change quite the same. Savine glanced over at Leo, his hard face a pale spot among all those splendid uniforms.
All both more or less than we were.
And Ricker swept a glass of wine from a passing tray, swallowed half at one gulp.
You remember my last visit here?
Chiseled into my memory. Savine wondered how many people who had laughed and drunk and danced in the Hall of Mirrors that night were dead now. Half? More? A chilly gust swept across the gardens, and it was the most she could do not to shiver.
Not my proudest moment, Ricker was saying. Played a pigeon at a peacock contest. Got caught by the queen in her son's bed, then shat myself at a parade. What's become of Orso?
Savine tried not to sound strangled, but did not entirely succeed.
No one knows. Careless for a country to lose its king. But I hear you've found another, so no harm done, eh?
Apart from that to the stability of the Union, the prospects of Savine's children, her own position and the state of her marriage, all of which she had thrown into jeopardy by setting Orso free against all good judgment.
None that cannot be mended, I hope.
You were kind to me that evening. You give the best gifts. Ricker hooked the emeralds around her neck and held them up to the light, then peered down at the runes Savine was wearing, the ones Ricker had given her in return.
And you even kept mine to you.
Nothing else would have suited the occasion.
Well, I won't be swapping back if that's what you're hoping.
And Ricker flicked open a fan with a snap, started wafting herself as gracefully as any regular at the theatre.
Am I doing it right?
And she peered down her nose, setting a few strands of hair, no doubt left loose for the purpose, fluttering about her tattooed face.
I may have to come to you for lessons.
Ha! Again! You were kind to me that night, and you're being kind now. You're a lot kinder than folk make out.
I doubt everyone would say so.
Savine lowered her voice.
I did betray you to Stour Nightfall, after all. I did betray you to King Orso. No doubt we both had our reasons. Doesn't mean we're not friends.
And she grinned sideways, a grin with a hint of danger.
I mean, what's the use of stabbing your enemies in the back?
Those bastards you can stab in the front, murmured Savine, taking a quick pinch of pearl dust. There was a time she would have hidden it, but who would dare disapprove now? She offered the box to Ricker.
My governess in Ostenhorn once said that when abroad, one should observe the local customs.
Rika drained her glass, then whipped off one of her gloves to take a hefty pinch, nudged the gold ring through her nose to the side, and noisily snorted it up.
"By the dead!"
She stuck her tongue out, blinking back tears.
"That burns!"
"It grows on you, believe me." Rika held on to Savine's arm as she stifled a sneeze, then pulled a little brown pellet from her glove and held it out.
"We can swap gifts this time, too."
"Chaga?" Savine took it from Rika's fingers and tucked it down behind her lip, then could not help a shudder.
"That tastes..."
She could hardly find the words to describe its earthy bitterness. Rika chomped on a pellet of her own and winked.
"It grows on you, believe me."
All about the gardens, people were swapping gifts and stories, forming strange partnerships and embracing the unknown. Kernsbeck was talking in a mixture of broken northern, shouted common, and flamboyant gestures to a set of merchant women swamped in furs. Something about chimneys, Savine thought. Probably they understood the details as well as she ever had. Celeste Dan Huygen, meanwhile, giggled as she worked her own brand of magic on the monocled hillman.
"There's copper in these mountains of yours?"
Her nose twitching as if she could smell the prophets, while his gaze strayed so far it was a wonder his eye lens didn't drop down the front of her dress.
"We have thousands counting on us now."
Savine watched Lord Isher and some long-bearded chieftain shake hands with immense dignity.
"We must look to the future. That's what I'm all about. But what could we savages have to offer civilization?"
"Civilization just finished a round of slaughter to make the Bloody Nine blush. The North has some remarkable natural advantages."
"You said the same about me when I last came to Adua.
And time has proved me more right even than I knew. When Leo and I travelled across the north last year..."
"To betray me to Stour?"
"Exactly, before you betrayed us both. I saw vast forests ready to be given over to the saw, great marshes ready to be drained and brought under the plough, hills rich with coal and iron scarcely mined, river after river surging swiftly to the sea, begging to be channeled, dammed, and harnessed by water wheels.
You saw opportunities."
"I may have no beautiful runes upon my face, but I can look into the future too, in my own way."
"Savine of the Long Eye."
Rika thoughtfully stuck her bottom lip out, glancing towards the wall of the Agriant, beyond which a set of chimneys were still puffing vapours even as the sun set.
"So you could help me do to the north what you lot have done to Adua?"
"I could help you do to the north whatever you want. For a price." Savine smiled her sweetest smile, the one she had always used to seal deals.
"For our mutual benefit. I do give the best gifts."
And she slid a gentle fingertip under the emeralds Rika wore, weighed them a moment, then laid them gently back against her skin. "But not only out of kindness. I freely admit I greatly underestimated you."
"Oh, you didn't come out of it too badly. Stour Nightfall did the same, and he's hosting no garden parties, I promise you."
From a few strides off, one would have taken it all for good-natured blather. But there was an edge on Ricker's every word. A conversation with her was a cake full of razors.
"You proved yourself a cunning and resourceful enemy," said Savine.
"When I am lucky enough to find one of those, I do everything I can to turn them into a friend."
"That's nice to hear from someone as cunning and resourceful as you. Nothing would warm my heart more than your friendship, but it's not my heart that brought me here."
Rika tipped up her chin, looking down her nose at Savine, then reached behind her head and nudged her hat forwards so the brim cast her eyes into shadow.
"My head holds a worry when it comes to looking to the future."
That twinkling left eye slid over to Leo, frowning at the festivities with grim detachment.
I'm talking to the wrong half of the marriage.
When Savine offered a gift, she was used to it being accepted. She never offered one until she was sure it would be. But she kept smiling in spite of her annoyance.
I and my husband have always had an equal partnership, she said.
Please.
And Ricker nudged Savine with a sharp elbow. When you came to visit me in Urfrith, you had him saddled like a pony. She beamed around at the gathering, showing every one of those fine teeth again.
Now everyone admires you, envies you, loves you, the darling of the slums. When they talk of you, your girls May and Liddy can't find praise high enough.
You are all far too kind, said Savine.
But it's not your soldiers on every street corner, is it?
And Ricker snapped her fan out between them and glided away, taking the last word with her. For now, at least. Leo felt a bit of an outsider at his own party. It should have been a palace function where he finally felt at home. It was his home now, after all. He'd earned it, he'd won it, and it was full of Northmen. The feel of the gardens was closer to the Dogman's old hall in Urfrith than the stuffy receptions of King Jezal's reign. But the blunt northern accents and the bluff northern laughter only made him think of how he used to be. That fearless, generous, reckless young fool who could run all day and never tire, who could beat all his friends with their choice of weapons, who stood not far from this spot after he won a duel against Stour Nightfall, loved and admired by all. The young lion, a hero with the world at his two good feet. By the dead, he missed that man. He made the one hand that worked into a fist so tight the knuckles clicked, felt the unpleasant tingling in the other as the fingers twitched in sympathy inside his jacket. He watched Ricker strut away from Savine, both of them smiling like warmer words were never said. His old lover and his new, or two old lovers, maybe. Wasn't much affection between him and the Lady Regent these days. Since she helped Orso escape, any warm feelings were strictly for the benefit of observers. It reminded him of his parents' marriage towards the end. A lie it suited everyone to pretend was true even years later. Maybe everyone follows in their parents' footsteps, doomed to blunder into the same mistakes like a blind man into furniture. All our paths set before birth, inevitable, like Kernsbeck's useless fucking cart, only running on the rails it's given. The only choice you have is how fast you'll roll to the end of the line. A depressing thought. Leo was having a lot of those lately. It wasn't as if he was left alone. The maggots kept coming, to smile, bow, flatter, always with that needy nervousness in their eyes, that oily fear in their voices, always trying to winkle something from him. It made him sick, their petty selfishness, their blinkered greed. He was covered from morning till night in a grease of lies. There was no scrubbing off. But that's what you're left with once you've led your real friends to their deaths. He watched Durand and Glaward talking to Ricker. The few survivors of those carefree times laughing together without him. And he ground his false foot into the lawn until the stump of his leg ached. He'd been thinking about sending Glaward away. Some foreign posting. So Leo wouldn't have to look at his stupid face. So he'd have Durand to himself. He'd won everything, and still he was endlessly angry, endlessly jealous. But then he'd lost everything too. He took a sour slurp of wine, watching Ricker plough through the throng. She didn't work the crowd with Savine's silky subtlety. She did it in a way all her own. With her big smile and her crazy eyes and that easy laughter and those wild gestures, wine sloshing from her glass as she threw up an arm. He could have limped over. It would have felt good to meet her halfway, to find the honest smile he used to have around her. His face could still make that shape, couldn't it? But but she'd betrayed him, so it would have been a kind of surrender. The young lion might have suffered defeats, but he'd never surrendered, never, whatever it cost him. So he stood there, patience wearing down, while Ricker chatted to Lord Isha, while she compared necklaces with Celeste Danhuygen, while she fanned the hair combed over Dietem Dancourt's head into flyaway wisps. It seemed as if she'd given every guest a compliment before she finally reached him, grinning as if there was no chasm full of broken promises yawning between them. "If it isn't Black Ricker." The northern words felt good in his mouth, he had to admit. "The beautiful and mysterious Witch of the North. You look well." She looked better than ever in her own mad way. No doubt Antaup would have been nudging and ooing and fawing at the sight of her, even more eagerly than he used to, had Leo not got him killed. "If it isn't little Leo, the biggest man in the Union." Behind the regal bearing and the costume and the tattoos, did he catch a glimpse of that awkward girl he used to know? Used to love, even. The thought seemed to hurt right in his chest. "We've come a long way, haven't we?" She leaned close, the smell of chagger on her warm breath, bringing all those times they'd lain together rushing back. "Since fucking in a stable?" He felt himself blushing, the way his mother always made him blush when a conversation didn't go her way. "Everyone had fun that night," he said, stiff and unconvincing. "And everyone's having fun now," managing to sound bitter too. "Not you," said Ricker, watching him over the rim of her glass. That flash of honesty might have shaken him from his gloom once. Now it pushed him deeper. "Fun is for people with all their limbs," he grunted. The sun had fully set, and the party was turning wild, the pent-up terror of the great change released, maybe. Issa Nefail had pulled her purple skirts right up to her crotch and was showing a scar on her muscular thigh to Zuri, who considered it with her black brows high. Shivers, General's jacket open to his grizzled chest, was offering his drawn sword to Glaward, who looked like he might have cut his thumb on the edge as he studied the silver mark near the hilt. By the dead, a hillman had commandeered a violin and was sawing out a barely passable jig to gales of shrill laughter from a tipsy Isolde Dan Isha. "I'm sorry," said Ricker softly. She wasn't smiling anymore. "Sorry I didn't come to help. Sorry I broke my word. It hurts me to see you hurt. Can't blame you if you don't believe it. Can't blame you if you don't care. But I'm sorry." Leo felt the sting of tears in his eyes. He hadn't realized how badly he'd wanted to hear it. He wanted to say he was sorry too. Take her hand, kiss her cheek, be her friend. The dead knew he needed one. The way they had been long ago, sitting up in the rafters of her father's hall. But those children were long gone. Leo hadn't chosen to make himself fearsome, but that was what the times demanded, for the sake of his country, his family, his wife, whether they thanked him or not. Softness now was weakness, weakness now was death. He could see no way back. A chill breeze whipped the feathers on the ladies' hats, made the torch flames flash and flicker. "Sorry won't bring my leg back, will it?" he snapped. "It won't bring Jin back, or Antaup, or all the others who died that day." She glanced at him sharply from under the brim of her hat. "Really? All Tricky Ricker's fault? I didn't make you turn rebel. I didn't talk you into fighting a battle. I didn't put the spur to your horse on the day. You sent a bloody letter to Orso, though." He saw Durand look over, tried to bring his voice down and failed. "I fought for you. I risked my life for you, and you betrayed me." He'd been hoping for more guilt. Instead, he got an angry snort. "What was I supposed to do? Laugh along while you sold Ufrith to Stour? See everything my father worked for? What?" snapped Leo. Ricker narrowed her eyes, the tattoos on her forehead twisting as she frowned. Somewhere in the distance, there was a soft rumble of thunder.
"Your wife stabbed me in the back the first chance she got, bought the great wolf's help with my home."
Here was a part of the story Savine had conveniently left out. Leo stared over at his wife, standing beside the great machinist in her usual dazzling white, and found her looking back, studying them, trying to gauge what they might be saying and how to turn it to her advantage.
"You didn't know that?" asked Ricker.
Leo shut his eyes.
By the dead, had he learned nothing? Of course he hadn't persuaded Stour to follow him to the Union out of brotherly feeling. Of course Savine struck a deal. And of course she'd done it behind his back.
Rain had started spitting down, white streaks frozen in the torchlight. Servants struggled with portable awnings as the wind picked up. A woman chased after a lost hat as it tumbled across the lawns.
"No,"
he bit off every word.
"I did not know that."
He glowered over at Savine again, but she wasn't even looking now, laughing gracefully at some joke of Kernsbeck's, as if Leo's pain didn't matter a shit to her either way. So she was as much to blame as anyone for Stauffenbeck, for everything he'd lost there. More. Finding that Ricker had good reasons for turning on him should have been the perfect chance to forgive her. But news of one more wounding betrayal by his wife didn't sweeten Leo's mood. They'd both stabbed him in the back while they stabbed each other in the face. Yet somehow they could glide away friends, ruling the gardens, loved by all, while he was left nursing unhealable wounds, hated and feared and alone.
"Why did you come here, Ricker?" he snarled, "dressed up like the fucking fortune teller at an overpriced carnival."
Her jaw worked.
"My father always said we should set our feuds aside if we could. Told me one score settled only plants the seeds of two more. I was hoping to put the past behind us and look to the future. Please, Leo, there's been enough bloodshed between the North and the Union."
He gave a joyless snort.
"Oh, I could stand more bleeding from the right bodies. Your wife seemed minded to forgive, and I always reckoned her the ruthless one."
"So did I.
But apparently I've been wrong about a great many things."
By the dead, what Leo really wanted was for her to put her arms around him and hold him the way she'd held Savine. But somehow, without meaning to, he'd made himself into a man no one wanted to touch.
"It's good to see you again, Ricker. Really it is. I miss what we had. Really I do."
"You miss what you had," she said softly. "You miss what you were."
"If you like."
Another crackle of thunder, louder, nearer. The way the damp banners rustled put Leo in mind of Red Hill, of Stour Nightfall's standard and his own, two young gods facing each other across the bridge. But memories of past glories only made his fury cut deeper.
"The truth is, I'm a lot less forgiving than I was. The way I see it, you owe me."
"Owe you what? An arm and a leg?"
"Something," he hissed in her face.
Glowered glanced worriedly over, call shivers too. Leo ignored them.
"You owe me something, and I'll collect. If I have to march to Carlion and rip it from your hands."
She didn't back off, not a step. There was a lot of her father in the stubborn set to her face, glittering specks of rain across the fur on her shoulders.
"If you want war, the North will fight you. Fight you as one. You can count on that."
Anger was safe. He knew where he stood with it.
"Oh, Ricker."
It might have been the first time he'd smiled that night. A hard smile, half a snarl, lips curled back from his teeth.
"You know how much I love a fight."
And he turned on his heel and strode back into the palace, or came as close to striding as he could, metal ankles squeaking with each lurching step. It was bloody raining now, anyway.
"I don't like it," grunted Tunny, nudging back the wet bushes to peer across the middle way.
"Neither do I,"
said Hildy, wet shoulders hunched around her wet ears.
"Well, frankly, neither do I,"
said Orso. "I can't remember the last time I liked anything." He puffed a sigh into the rain.
"But what choice do we have?"
Royal servants aren't generally supposed to disagree with kings, of course, but that had never stopped these two before, and he had been faintly hoping they might leap forwards with some unexpected alternative. The only sound they made, though, was the faint chattering of Hildy's teeth. Brock had the city sealed as tightly as Valent and Bulk's famous vault. They were hungry, cold, exhausted, and entirely out of friends. A likely reward of thousands of marks for your capture really was a heavy load to place on anyone's loyalty. It was getting to the point where Orso was considering turning himself in, if it meant he could afford a decent meal. They all shrank back at the sound of clattering hooves, a gilded carriage whirring through the wet night beyond the bushes in its own pool of light. Orso was sure he heard a drunken titter echoing from its open window.
"Guests leaving the royal function?"
he murmured wistfully.
"Wonder which of the perennial arse-lickers is in there?"
grunted Hildy with a sour sniff.
"That lying slime Huygen? That treacherous bastard Isher?" "Tongues neatly extracted from my rear and slipped between the young lion's scarred buttocks, without so much as a blush, no doubt. They used to huddle around me at those bloody events, like geese at the trough."
"You miss it?" asked Tunny.
"I don't miss the sycophancy,"
mused Orso, putting a hand to his growling stomach.
"I do miss the food."
"And the clothes," said Tunny.
"And the roofs,"
said Hildy, squinting up at the steadily pissing heavens.
"And the not being hounded by bitter enemies with unlimited resources who control every gate, wharf, and corner."
Orso cringed into the shadows again at the sound of tramping feet. Beyond the bushes, wet armour gleamed as yet another patrol came past.
"Those were good times,"
he whispered. There was a brief pause.
"Admit it," said Tunny. "You miss the sycophancy too." "Little bit, but honestly, I was in a wretched state back then. I actually feel much more cheerful starving out here in the rain."
Orso gave a disbelieving chuckle. He was a riddle even to himself.
"Once I'm out of the city,"
he did not mention the other more likely possibility, the one involving a halving of the number of living High Kings of the Union.
"You should have no trouble getting away yourselves. Tunny, send that standard to my mother and sister in Supani. They can use it as a tablecloth or something."
"It'll stay on the pole," growled Tunny, "and be ready when you need it."
"Let me come with you."
Hildy gripped him by the wrist.
"You need someone with you."
"No. You just get in the way."
His voice failed him slightly on the last word, and he had to clear a lump from his throat. He suspected they both guessed the real reason he had to leave them, that their loyalty to him had cost them enough already, and it was time for him to repay the favour and take his own risks. He prized her fingers gently free.
"What's our tally at now?"
216 marks.
Hildy was pretending her eyes were wet from the rain and fooling no one.
"And 30 bits?
Sounds a touch high.
I'm never wrong about numbers."
"She's never wrong about numbers," said Tunny.
"No."
Orso wrapped his hands gently around her fist.
"I am so, so sorry, Hildy. But I think, for now, I'll have to owe you."
"If they hurt you, I'll be revenged on the bastards,"
she snarled at him, wet eyes suddenly blazing.
"I swear."
Orso smiled then. It was an effort, considering everything, but he managed it. I appreciate the thought more than you can know, but if anything happens to me, I'd really rather you let it go. He laid a hand gently on Hildy's wet cheek. Have a life instead. You deserve it.
Ricker stumbled getting down from the carriage and would have gone flat on her face, but that nice man Haroon caught her and whisked her up straight again like she weighed nothing at all, which she had to admit she quite enjoyed.
Thank you very much, she said, patting his arm.
Quite an arm, far as she could tell. Then she teetered across the slick cobbles towards the steps. Bloody things wouldn't stay still, wobbling about all over the place. Or was that her? She was drunk as shit and making no apologies.
No forgiveness from little Leo, then?
Asked Isern, damp skirts gathered up to her knees so she could clamber to the front door.
Don't think he's got any, said Ricker.
The thought of their little exchange chased the pleasant glow of drink away for a moment.
The boys turned dark, dark and vengeful.
I could have told you that when I saw all the bloody flags. Flags never add to a man, d'ye see, just stand in for something he's missing. He always was a bully, and not too clever, but you can forgive a lot for a nice ass and a nice smile.
Isern shook herself at the top of the steps, like a dog who'd run through a river, raindrops flying from her wet hair.
Now his arse is in ruins, and I didn't see him smile all night.
Might be I was too sharp with him, fretted Ricker. Come all this way to heal wounds, and all I did was rub salt in him.
Partly it was the pearl dust, which had made her feel quick-tongued, numb-faced, and also rather frisky.
Might be I should have grovelled more.
Shit on that! Isern turned the doorknob, and they spilled into the hall together, leaving a crooked trail of wet footprints.
You're the North now, and the North kneels to no one. Besides, a man who's moved by grovelling will never get enough grovelling for his taste. Let him once set his foot on your back, and you'll have a fucking boot print twixt your shoulder blades till the day you're buried. What are you doing still up?
Shivers was leaning against the wall, pipe in his hand, puffing a plume of chagger smoke a manufactory chimney might have been proud to produce.
You have a visitor, he said.
Ricker giggled.
Tell me it's a handsome man.
Shivers scratched gently at his great scar.
I'm no expert on handsome, but I have heard him described so.
And he nudged the door beside him, creaking open. Ricker stepped frowning towards it.
Well, this is a tantalizing mystery and no...
She stopped just over the threshold, staring.
Bloody fuck!
He half sat, half lay, draped across the cushions on one of those things between a chair and a bed they had down here, a mostly empty glass of wine dangling from one hand. His hair was a damp tangle, his face smudged with dirt, his clothes stained and torn, but his grin was the same as when he'd brought her an egg in bed, and it looked better than ever.
Bloody fuck! Your Majesty, said Orso. Everyone's calling themselves that these days, muttered Ricker. I hear even babies are doing it. Much to my dismay.
You look... She took a step or two into the room, felt like she couldn't help it.
A touch less prosperous than last time we met. I can only apologize for my wretched appearance. I have been slightly on the run the last few days. I'd have thought you'd be used to being pursued. Of course, furious creditors, needy ambassadors, jilted lovers, husbands of jilted lovers, families of jilted lovers and so forth, but Leo Danbrock really does represent a new level of damnable persistence. He's like a dog with a bone. Lion with a bone, maybe.
So you're the bone? Asked Ricker, raising her brows. Orso smiled a little wider.
Poor choice of words, perhaps. You look like the fucking fortune teller at an overpriced carnival.
His eyes moved over her dress,
which was clinging somewhat from the rain, then up to her face, her blind eye and her long eye, the black rings pricked into the skin around it. I was going to say beautiful and mysterious. Oh, Ricker found she was tidying a damp strand of her hair behind her ear and made herself stop. Well, in that case, proceed. Don't like this at all, came Isern's voice in Northern. She was right at Ricker's shoulder, her tattooed arm and her pale tightly folded across her purple ball dress and her narrowed eyes fixed suspiciously on Orso. This is dangerous.
Never mind that, said Ricker,
herding her towards the door. She was keenly aware of how dangerous it was. Maybe that was the appeal. Maybe she was a moth drawn to the flame and would very soon go up in a fireball.
You need to think about this, Ricker.
Isern caught the doorframe, leaning close to growl under her breath.
Just don't be thinking with your quim. Yes, yes. Make of your quim a stone.
Ricker managed to bundle her out into the hall, wrestled the door shut, and leaned back against it with an overwide grin. Orso was looking approvingly around the room, which was almost as big as Scarling's hall, and a damn sight more expensively furnished, with glittering vases and polished wood and candles twinkling in gilded holders.
So, you won.
I did, said Ricker, enjoying a little swagger about the tiles herself. Nothing had been easily won after all. Might as well enjoy it.
I lost, said Orso, but without much rancor. So I hear.
He stood, took the stopper from the decanter with a pleasant clinking of glass.
The Queen of the Northmen. Just Black Ricker. If you got the power, you don't need the title.
I was always the other way around. So many titles, no power at all. And also snapped out a little laugh and started pouring two glasses of wine. He looked even more carelessly at ease as the Union's most wanted outlaw than he had as its crown prince.
Your friend Isern isn't wrong. I'm afraid I'm...
And he looked up from under his brows with that smile that seemed to give her a sharper tickle every time.
Trouble. And you're happy to tread trouble across my carpet? My old standard-bearer thought it was a bad idea, but... No one would expect me to come to you.
I'll confess, I'm fucking astonished.
But the truth was, Ricker was glad to see him, and not just because of the pearl dust and the drink, though partly because of the pearl dust and the drink, and partly because he was handsome and funny and charming, and the certain knowledge that he was a very excellent lover was kissing constantly at the back of her pearl-dusted mind. She had to keep herself hidden these days, behind the tattoos and the knowing smiles and the stony heart. With him, she could let herself show.
I need someone to get me out of Adua, he said. Someone powerful, someone brave, someone with a large entourage in which an extra face, suitably obscured, might go unnoticed. And you did write me that letter, after all, so I wondered if you might still have some trifling attachment to my lost cause. Mostly suited my own needs, if I'm honest. But it's true, I've always liked lost causes. There was something else.
He paused, his grin curling wider, as if he was casting his mind back to a happy memory.
That night we spent together, and that morning after. I've thought about it often.
She couldn't help smiling herself.
So have I.
In fact, she was thinking about it right now, and she pulled one of those ridiculous lace gloves off with her teeth. It was all out of shape from the damp anyway.
I've wondered, now and again, what might have happened had we been different people.
She licked her finger and thumb and started snuffing out candles, each one dying with a little fizz and a curl of smoke.
So have I.
The room gradually grew dimmer, gradually felt hotter, in spite of the clammy fabric clinging to her, till there was only the gleam on the gold thread in the curtains, on the silverware and the glassware at the corners of Orso's smiling eyes. And, well, we're different people now, he said. No doubt, we're all of us changed. All the things seen since then, the things done, the people gone back to the mud. He'd lost his throne, she'd gained one. But as she came close and took the glass from his hand, he had that same look in his eyes he'd had that night, that look of unguarded desire. And being looked at that way felt just as good. Better than ever, maybe. She knocked the wine off in one throw, then had to stand there wincing, one hand pressed to her chest, fighting the urge to puke it back up. That would have been quite the mood killer.
Need a bucket? He asked.
No, I think I've got it.
Fighting down an acrid little tickle at the back of her throat with a shudder.
Under control?
And she took her wet hat off and started to slide the pins from her hair, toss them on the table beside her so they bounced and clicked and tumbled, twinkling on the floor. She was a leader. She had responsibilities, hard choices to make. But they could wait till tomorrow.
Sometimes feels like life's just a long preparation for something, she said,
and she put a finger on his chest and pushed him so he had no choice but to sit down, hard, wine slopping from his glass.
Hard work getting everything right for a perfect future.
And she scrubbed her damp hair with her nails, scrubbed it back into its usual wild tangle, then blew a stray strand out of her face.
But nothing's ever finished, is it? Nothing's ever right. Not really. Certainly not in my experience, he whispered, slightly throaty, as she reached out and perched the hat slanted on his head. And if it is, it turns wrong soon enough.
She took two fistfuls of her damp dress and gathered it up.
It rots. It rusts. It dies.
Gathered it up all the way to her thighs, goose-fleshed from the cold outside and the warm inside.
Life's naught but a set of moments.
And she slipped one knee onto the cushions to either side of him, lowered herself gently into his lap.
You've got to live each one. I've always thought so, he murmured, eyes fixed on hers. All that time spent tending the garden, she whispered.
Seemed fine luck now she hadn't bothered with all that mass of underwear they'd trussed themselves up in down here.
You forget to sit back in the garden and enjoy it.
And she pushed her hands into his hair, cool and damp from the rain, and twisted his face up towards hers and started to kiss him.